keeping you updated.
This is The Agenda with Georgia Tolley.
On Dubai Eye 103.8.
Hello there, and thank you for downloading this podcast from Wednesday, the 16th of March. I'm Georgia Tolley, and on the programme today, we found out more about how Dubai police collaborate with other forces. I spoke to the Commander-in-Chief of Dubai Police about the importance of global police collaboration. We also found out how DNA analysis is being used to catch more criminals than ever before. Hanan Al-Mullah, who is a forensic genetics expert for Dubai Police, joined us on the programme. We also discussed how the UAE managed to rank so highly in the Global Soft Power Index and what it means. That was with Adam Ramey, who is Associate Professor for Political Science at NYU Abu Dhabi. And as the International Humanitarian Aid and Development Conference is taking place in Dubai at the moment, we heard about the pressing issues facing this region with Dr. Hossam El-Shaqri, the Regional Director of the Red Cross and Red Crescent. And we were also joined by Majid Yahia, who is the Director of the World Food Programme in this region. Meanwhile, with Ramadan fast approaching, we discussed reduced working hours and the return of iftar tents with Abdullah Al-Sakal from the Sheikh Mohammed Centre for Cultural Understanding.
Keeping you updated.
This is The Agenda with Georgia Tolley
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Welcome back. So yes, I did manage to leave the confines of the radio studio yesterday. I drove down immediately after the show to Expo 2020 Dubai, where the World Police Summit is taking place. I managed to get there just in time to do an interview with the Commander-in-Chief of Dubai Police, no less, Major General Abdullah Khalifa Al-Mari. Now, he talked to me about the importance of global police collaboration.
In the summit here, we try to push this relation and contact. I just had a meeting today with the three chief of police this morning here. I think in Dubai or UAE government or Dubai police, I think we are well established with other police around the world.
It's good that so many good relations are going. Do you share intelligence? Do you share contacts?
Yes, we share, a lot of things with them when it comes to sharing, let's say, security information, sharing best practice, sharing whatever technology we're using here. As you see, we have Dubai Police stand here just in the middle, and we try to present whatever we have to show them.
I know that you've collaborated on a lot of really quite high-profile arrests recently of drug dealers, of people traffickers. That shows a sort of growth in your relationship with international police forces. And of course, there was the Interpol appointment.
Yes, what we believe, to have those chief of police around us here in this summit here, to have that sort of direct communication and contact with them. As you said, recently we had a lot of people being taken off here. It's a credit not for Dubai police, but for the whole law enforcement around the world.
As mentioned there, there has been a senior UAE official who was elected Interpol president just recently. Ahmed Nasser Al-Raisi will serve a 4-year term. And we have seen a lot of collaboration between the UAE police and their global counterparts. There's been several very, very high profile arrests, not least the Hush Puppy arrest. Do you remember that one? He is, still awaiting trial. But there's been plenty of we've seen plenty of that type of negotiations. There must have been a great deal of sharing of information and contacts in those situations. Now, one of the other headline topics at the conference, which is there's sort of several conferences which are running alongside the summit, is the use of forensics to catch criminals. And one of the keynote speakers is Hanan Al-Mullah, who is a forensic genetics expert for Dubai Police. You can hear me stumbling over her title there because I'm going to be stumbling over quite a lot of this interview because it's incredibly complex, Hanan's work. She is going to explain the improvements that we've seen in DNA analysis to catch criminals. So Hanan, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate you taking the time. Hello. And if you can hear a bit of noise in the background, that is because Hanan is live from the World Police Summit. So it is fantastic that you've been able to take the time to join us. Thank you so much. I can see you on Microsoft Teams. Hello. So tell me a little bit more about DNA analysis and how it is used to catch criminals. I suppose this is ultimately the essence of your profession.
Yeah, exactly. So one of the interesting things actually about DNA and forensics is that it is one of the more younger fields in the many, many disciplines in forensics. I think it started in the 1980s. So basically, as many of you already know from like very exciting documentaries and crime shows, that every person has a unique DNA. So basically, it's like your genetic fingerprint. The only people who have the same DNA is identical twins. And so when the DNA started in forensics, it was very useful because, number one, it is abundant in the human body. Everything in your body has your DNA in it, except, of course, for the red blood cells. And it had a huge impact, especially with removing innocent people from incarceration, even after like decades and decades of being there.
I have to say that your job is something out of a crime novel. Like you must be up there with one of the coolest jobs to do in the whole of the world. I mean, especially with the sort of explosion of crime TV just recently, and of course the sort of the real crime docudrama series. Has there been a great deal of progress made? Because I understand the principle of DNA analysis, but I wonder whether there's been a sort of giant leap forward, so to speak, in recent years.
Yeah, because our field in forensics is very scientific, so innovations and improvements come from research. And the specific project that I talked about yesterday was actually, you can say that it is one of the innovations that we have in Dubai Police. So we are actually looking at a very different and unique type of DNA, one that is only present in the males and not in the females. It is called the Y chromosome or the Y DNA. And so because it is only present in the females, fathers inherited to their sons without it being mixed in with the mother's DNA. And so what you have is that one family, all of the members, the male members, they are shared the same Y DNA. So this one is used for familial testing. So if you have two people with the same Y chromosome DNA, then you can say they are close relatives. What we did with our innovation, and me and my colleagues, led by Lieutenant Colonel Dr. Rash Lavafri, we looked for different specific locations in this Y chromosome where even close male relatives will show very different profiles. And now you can identify people individually with their Y chromosome instead of them sharing it.
That sounds very useful indeed in, yes, in solving crimes and you know, detecting individuals and defining, you know, who was actually present. I mean, obviously my brain jumps straight to sort of a murder scene, you know, with, yeah, a line drawn around a body kind of scenario. But what other scenarios can you see that technology, this new technology you've come up with, being used?
Well, actually, you can use it anywhere in forensics, wherever you need. So a lot of times the standard DNA that you have, which is unique to every person present in the male and female, sometimes it is too degraded or too weak. That happens in like half of the cases. So when you have that condition, you go for the Y DNA. And when previously, for example, a father would cover for his son or a brother would like point the finger to his other siblings, what you can do now with this technology is separate between the identities of these relatives. And also, if, for example, you have a mass grave and you want to study it and identify the population from which they came from, you can actually use the Y chromosome to trace back to the geographical origin of the unknown person and see which population he came from.
And so how long have you been working on this project? Because I have to say, I don't really imagine the Dubai Police Force as being as focused on scientific research as it clearly is.
Actually, the leader of the project that I mentioned, Dr. Rash Lughafi, he started it in 2015 as his PhD project. So it was in its initial version then. It was able to differentiate between individuals more than the previous kits, but not as it does right now. And so this specific research continued from that 2015 study, and it started last year in 2021. We were able to finish it quickly and successfully with collaboration from a company in China called MicroRead, So together we designed the kit, we produced it, and then we are now marketing and commercializing it. So it took a year, which was a good thing.
I have to ask, and in many ways I hate to draw attention to it, but you are a young woman working in an unusual field in an Arab country. Does that feel unusual to you? Or when you look around your contemporaries, are you one of many?
Oh, I am one of many. You know, especially with the more scientific fields, you see a lot of women more than you see men. And more in the field work, you see more men and women. But I don't think that is the case now. Now you see everyone everywhere, you know. And it's nice because I have desk work, I have lab work, I have field work. And when people see me in field work sometimes, they say, oh, wow, you work with the crime scene. And I proudly say, oh, yes, I do.
Do you know?
Yeah.
I'm really looking forward to a time when that isn't worth comment, if you know what I mean. You know, when it's a normal thing. Yeah, when we've just moved past that and it's just normal. And I have to say, you know, I have to ask the question, is forensic science a bit like what we see on the television programs?
It is, and it is not in some cases. Even the even my colleagues told me that when they came here, they had a bit different expectations. So, for example, in the crime scene, you see one person doing everything. He's the investigator. He's the one lifting the items from the crime scene. He's the one in the laboratory doing everything. But really, it is one person focusing on a very specific field. And then what's great about it is that all of these different disciplines go into court as one cohesive case, which leads to the success of, you know, solving the crime. What I did expect and I did find is the excitement of working here. I never thought actually that I'd be working in the police, but when I did, I was very, very happy that I did. It's very exciting.
And I suppose the ultimate culmination of that will be when you see this research that you've worked on so explicitly over the last year, when that actually brings somebody to court. I mean, that must be an incredibly exciting moment.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's why we call this an innovation, because there's no kit that reached to the level of effectiveness that our kit does. So it will definitely have that impact, I predict, and especially because you can use this internationally. So this kit that we have, it applies to the normal and typical DNA analysis workflow in all forensic laboratories around the world, so they can use it exactly as they do their other commercial kits with the same instruments. And I do, yes, I know that it will have an impact.
Absolutely amazing to speak to you. Thank you so much for your time. I wish you all the best with
welcome.
Your research. And we must speak to you again. If you've got anything else coming up, any more projects, do stay in touch with us, because it would be, I mean, it's such a fascinating field for everyone, I think. We're all ambulance chasers at heart. We're all fascinated by real crime. So thank you so much for your time.
You're very welcome.
Pleasure. Right, that was Hanan Al-Mulla, who is a forensic genetics expert for Dubai Police.
You're listening to The Agenda with Georgia Tolley
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Right, it's Georgia Tolley here. They let me out the studio yesterday. It was very exciting. Immediately after the show, I got in the car and I zoomed off to Expo 2020 Dubai, because the World Police Summit is currently taking place there. You can go if you want to. I thought it was just for officials, but it's not. Visitor registration is completely free. Just go to worldpolicesummit.com. It's quite fun. There's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of conferences into cool things like drone technology and forensics. And there's a load of really impressive vehicles down there. I saw a hovercraft. There were lots of drones, as usual. Massive boat that that's armored. I mean, a huge amount. It was really good fun. So if you want to go, I would recommend going to the website, worldpolicesummit.com. One of those things that you would only happen in Dubai. So one of the great things was that I managed to arrive just in time. I'd like to give a big shout out to all the press officers who helped make this happen. The commander in chief of Dubai Police, no less, hung around for another couple of minutes to do an interview with me. I was a bit sweaty. I'd sprinted down the conference. A lot of policemen looked a little bit nervous about the crazy sprinting lady, but then realised that I probably wasn't going to try and mug them. So we had a wonderful interview with Major General Abdullah Khalifa Al-Mari. He was kind enough to spare a couple of minutes, and he talked to me about the importance of global police collaboration.
In the summit here, we try to push this relation and contact. I just had a meeting today with the three chief of police this morning here. I think in Dubai or UAE government or Dubai police, I think we are well established with other police around the world.
It's good that so many good relations are going. Do you share intelligence? Do you share contacts?
Yes, we share, a lot of things with them when it comes to sharing, let's say, security information, sharing best practice, sharing whatever technology we're using here. As you see, we have Dubai Police stand here just in the middle, and we try to present whatever we have to show them.
I know that you've collaborated on a lot of really quite high-profile arrests recently of drug dealers, of people traffickers. That shows a sort of growth in your relationship with international police forces. And of course, there was the Interpol appointment.
Yes, what we believe, to have those chief of police around us here in this summit here, to have that sort of direct communication and contact with them. As you said, recently we had a lot of people being taken off here. It's a credit not for Dubai police, but for the whole law enforcement around the world.
Worth mentioning there that, of course, the UAE's Ahmed Nasser Al-Raisi was elected Interpol president. He'll be serving a 4-year term and he was appointed back in November. I also had a chance to speak to a lot of the exhibitors, including Alexei Yermolaev. Now, he's from Inca's Vehicles. He had one, I have to admit, of one of the most eye-catching stands.
We're exhibiting here two vehicles from our product range. One is armored personal carrier named Titan DS, which can be used by SWAT, by law enforcement, police or military applications. Another vehicle is for civilian, but it's bulletproof, armored to B7 level. And we are showcasing the armored patrol boat from Aksum Marine, which is our sister company. Those vehicles and boat are made in United Arab Emirates. The factory for vehicles is located in Dubai, and factory for boats is located in Umm Al Quwain.
I had no idea that that type of vehicle was made here in the United Arab Emirates. Are they then used just in country, or are they exported around the world?
Most of our products are exported internationally. In country, we supply security companies like cash and transit vehicles, what is used, for example, by number of security companies in UAE, also top officials. But internationally, we supply NGOs, governments, ministries of defense, interior, embassies, and so on. Our main markets are Middle East, Africa, and Asia.
And have you seen an increase in business recently or an uptick? Has there been any sort of particular market movements of interest over the last few months or last few years?
Unfortunately, the world didn't become the safer place. So we can see the increased demand for the vehicles. There was some slowdown during COVID time, but now everyone is picking up what was, from before.
I imagine because the UAE has quite a large coastal area that there's quite a need for the patrol boat. Can you describe a little bit more about its uses and also its key elements?
Our patrol boats combining two very important features, speed, maneuverability and defense. Despite the boats provide the armoring protection, same as our vehicles. At the same time, they're not losing on their speed and maneuverability features.
And are they proving popular around the world? Are you getting interest? Because obviously here at the World Police Summit, we've got police officers from all around the world coming to visit and to learn about different vehicles that they could buy. Have you had a lot of international interest?
Yes. Indeed, we have a lot of international interest, and we are not new here. Our company is working in Dubai since 2014. We are dealing directly with Abu Dhabi, Dubai government. So constantly they know about us, and if there is demand here, they are contacting us directly. And internationally also we have our presence in a lot of countries in Africa, Middle East and so on. We are supplying UN as well.
That was Alexei Yermolaev from Inkas Vehicles. Now, riot vehicles and police drones were also on display, and it's emerged that four drones deployed at the Expo 2020 Dubai site have actually been helping keep the perimeters of the World's Fair secure day and night for the past 6 months. The devices have also enabled Dubai police to cut their response time on the site from 4.4 minutes to only one. Another exhibitor on site at the World Police Summit was Rod Mann from the surveillance and security company Apex Vanguard. Now, he'd travelled from the UK to host a stand at the summit.
We have a unique canine camera system, which is a multi-platform system. But what's really unique about it is it's the first canine system that has three unique cameras in it: thermal imaging, infrared, and a widescreen day camera. Also, two-way audio is present on the device as well, so the handler can speak to the dog to guide him to where he needs to be.
And so what sort of circumstance would this canine unit be used?
It has a wide range of applications in terms of users, from border force to police, military, and search and rescue applications.
And is it proving popular? Is this the first time? I mean, it's the inaugural World Police Summit. Is it the first time you've been exhibiting here in the UAE?
Yes, it is our first time here in the UAE. We're very pleased to be here and seeing the Dubai Police with all their incredible innovations that they have. And they're a very forward-thinking force. So we thought coming to this exhibition would be a great combination.
Do you think this could be a good sales opportunity?
Absolutely. We've had non-stop interest at the show from various police forces and also military interest as well, because of the amount of applications the system has, from firearms teams to canine units to search and rescue. So yes, we've had a lot of interest locally and internationally from this show.
That is Rod Mann from the surveillance and security company Apex Vanguard. So yes, if you do want to go and check out all of those displays, visitor registration is free, and you can find out more on worldpolicesummit.com.
You're listening to The Agenda with Georgia Tolley
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Right, we're going to talk sport because we've got a special live guest joining us in the studio at 5:30. It is our guest, Abdullah Al-Sakal. Now, he is the director of the Sheikh Mohammed Centre for Cultural Understanding. He is my first living human guest that has come into The Agenda, and I feel like it is a real... it's a real moment, because it means that we sort of moved past the COVID-19 pandemic to the extent that we can now welcome guests back into the Dubai Eye studio, which is almost the first time it's happened for about 2 years. So it is hugely exciting. And there's no coincidence that it is in connection to Ramadan, which is coming up. And we have had that announcement just recently, just in the last 24 hours, that tents for iftars will now be allowed again for the first time in 2 years. So we're very excited about that. We're very excited about talking to Abdullah. But first of all, I'm going to get very excited about talking about sport, because the F1 season is upon us. And Dane Swindles from the ARN News Centre has joined us in the studio to talk about it. Dane, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
I am good, thank you. Yeah, not bad at all. I had fun at the World Police Summit yesterday. There's nothing... You know, it's really good for a journalist to get out the studio more often. I need to go out and about more often. In that gap between the show and the school run, I need to go out and explore.
And it's nice to be at events again as well.
It is. It's nice that they're happening in person. I met lots of people who travelled from abroad. It was really, really... It's really cool. It's really cool. Life is good, Dane. Life is good.
Yes, it is.
Okay, so tell me a little bit more about what's going on in F1, where life is also good.
Yes. So... The Netflix series, which I told you about a while ago,
yes,
dropped
I've been
a few days ago.
It.
Yeah,
yes.
You need to. I'm waiting to see if I can spot myself at the Abu Dhabi section, where
yes,
all the drama is.
That it was such an exciting race.
Yeah. So this is kind of where the drama unfolds. A new season starts in Bahrain this weekend, but there's been some changes to safety car rules. So Formula One's governing body, the FIA, have changed the safety car rules to avoid a repeat of the drama that erupted last year for the title-deciding race in the capital in Abu Dhabi. Now, race director Michael Massey, who was replaced last month, changed the procedure in the closing laps at Yas Marina in a move that allowed Red Bull's Max Verstappen to pass Lewis Hamilton and take the title. So Hamilton would have otherwise taken a record 8th championship. That's where all the drama was. And the new season starts in Bahrain this weekend. So hopefully nothing else like that is going to happen this season.
I hope not, although it was great fun. It wasn't for me. It wasn't for you. It led to huge debates in the audience. Everyone was like, was he robbed? Most people, I have to say, did think he was robbed, but...
I've never seen so much drama in like that kind of area as well, like behind the scenes at the F1, like being in the driver's village and seeing everybody sort of freaking out that this was happening. It was so strange and surreal. But yes, exciting for the sport, but yeah.
Maybe not so good for the drivers who put their lives into it.
Yes, for sure.
So there's also been some very, very exciting news overnight in the Champions League.
Yeah, not if you're a Manchester United fan, though, because they've been knocked out of the Champions League at the last 16 stage by Atletico Madrid after losing 1-0 in the second leg tie at Old Trafford. So the Spanish champions go through 2-1 on aggregate, and United interim manager Ralf Rangnick wasn't very happy with Atletico's time wasting.
The second half, it was, I don't know if the game was played for more than 2 minutes without being interrupted, without somebody lying on the floor. And I think there was some curious refereeing decisions. I wouldn't necessarily say they were decisive.
So he does sound very cross there, talking about curious referee decisions and lots of people lying on the floor, which it seems to me is basically just standard in football, isn't it?
Settle down.
Okay, so what is going on with Barca? Is that how you say it if you're cool?
Yeah, Barcelona.
And their new sponsor.
Yeah, so this is really exciting. They have got a new sponsor for next season. Now, this is going to be a sponsor on the shirts and also for their very famous stadium as well. We're talking about Spotify. So the stadium will be renamed the Spotify Camp Nou Stadium. And the club calls it a first-of-its-kind partnership bringing music and football together. So it's going to be quite cool seeing the Spotify logo on the front of the Barcelona strip.
That is very, very cool. Almost as good as suing the Zoom logo at the F1.
Yes.
Where everyone, I don't even know if they actually did sponsor it, but everyone was like, oh, I didn't know they were doing subtitles at the F1.
Nice.
It was
nice.
Genius. Okay, finally, cricket. How's it going there?
Bowlers Mark Wood and Ollie Robinson have been ruled out of action for England, who begin their second test with the West Indies in Barbados today. Wood picked up an elbow injury in the first meeting between the teams and is replaced by Saqib Mahmood, who makes his first test debut. The first match ended in a draw.
There you go. Exciting news. Thank you so much, Dane. It's been a pleasure having you in the studio. We will welcome you back tomorrow, maybe.
Maybe.
Yeah, I hope so. We like to keep each other on our toes when it comes to the who's doing sport each day.
It's nice to wake up and not know what's happening.
Well, I like to. I just, you know, it keeps the energy going. It keeps me on my toes. Keeps you on your toes,
there we
exactly.
Go.
Keeping you updated.
This is The Agenda with Georgia Tully
on Dubai I 103.8.
Now, with the holy month of Ramadan just around the corner, it is expected to start it on the 2nd of April. Then it is our opportunity to start preparing for that time. We've got about 2 weeks to go. The official start date, of course, will be confirmed by the UAE's Moon Sighting Committee. The authorities are already preparing themselves to make sure that gatherings can take place safely. And we have had that big announcement, which is that the government will this year allow iftar tents again for the first time in 2 years. This is an absolutely brilliant development. And to discuss that, plus the other changes that we should expect this Ramadan, I am joined in the studio by Abdallah Al-Sakal. Now, he is the director of the Sheikh Mohammed Centre for Cultural Understanding. And it is a great pleasure to actually welcome him into the studio. So you are my first live guest since I started presenting The Agenda. So welcome to the studio.
Thank you so much for having me here. So proud of your work as Dubai Eye.
Thank you. It is wonderful to have you join us. Now, I mean, I'm not a Muslim, so I have to admit, I don't think I truly understand the importance of iftar and the importance of being able to gather en masse for that end of fast daily meal. How big a deal is it that iftar tents are going to be allowed again this year?
Well, breaking the fast en masse is a cultural thing. It's not like a religious requirement, but people do intend to give more of charity food for people who cannot afford to have daily iftar in large groups. So lots of donations, mass gathering outside the mosques, in houses, in tents. I don't know about this year, but people, I think, will be a kind of careful not to open so fast back to life is back to norm, but gatherings, it's a big question this Ramadan.
It absolutely is, and the authorities have introduced several regulations to make sure that the celebrations can be done safely. For example, the iftar tents have to be designed in the form of a canopy that's open from all sides or be air conditioned. Of course, Ramadan is happening earlier this year, as it does every year, so it will actually be cooler this year at iftar time.
Yes, talking about the 2nd of April, it's not. It's heading toward getting to the every year. See, Ramadan is a lunar calendar, so every 33 years we'll have it back in on the 2nd of April, 2nd or 3rd of April, every 33 years. So now it's heading toward the winter. So in 5-6 years, it will be in December, January. Well, weather is getting better.
It is getting better, which is great news. I mean, round about April, I suppose it does get a little bit hotter. I mean, the COVID rules have changed, which means that these iftars can go ahead. But do you think that Ramadan and the holy month will go back to normal like it was before the pandemic? Or do you think that things have changed? I mean, I remember pre-pandemic, the rules regarding restaurants had changed, for example. It used to be that most restaurants were closed during the day, and that has now changed here in the UAE.
Yes. When it comes to restaurants, UAE being cosmopolitan, open to the world, everything's beautiful about Dubai. It's just places, the people, the way Dubai thinks and the people think is different. So Ramadan, when it comes to restaurants, nothing's going to change. They're going to be open. But we're talking about how people are, families going to be back. I think the donations, the outside tents, donation tents will come back. But a lot of big families who normally receive for iftar guests and for the night gathering, which is after the night prayer, also people gather for the night gathering, that will be, I don't see it coming back this year.
Is that because...
That personally, talking about my father, has a large group of people coming for iftar before the pandemic. And it could reach up to, God bless his heart, 200, 300 people. He loves it. And the whole family comes from all over the UAE for iftar. But not this year. For the last 2 years, we didn't have it, of course. But not this year. He's still careful. He's in his 70s. So the family decided not to have the large iftar.
I mean, that's very sensible. And it is interesting to hear that caution is still being implemented by Emirati families. And it's understandable.
It is. It is understandable.
Absolutely. Yeah. That is so interesting that those changes will come in. I mean, do you feel that we were already sort of on a roll where there was no longer a divide between those who are Muslim and those who are not, as far as staying peaceful during the holy month? It is very important for non-Muslims to also respect those traditions and not play loud music and not have loud celebrations during that period.
As I said, the way life in Dubai is so easy for a non-Muslim to blend, to understand, to get his answers. But again, we are unique in getting everyone to live in an Arab, I would just say it's so simple. A country with abaya, a country with agal and kandura, why do they dress in white? Why do they dress in a country with lots of mosques, but at the same time, infrastructure, international, religions from all over the world, churches, synagogues, airplanes flying from all over the world, businesses. It's a chance for people to meet Emiratis, to meet Arabs, to meet Muslims from all over the world. It makes it a beautiful combination. So it's not too strict. It's not too do that, don't do that. The government doesn't even say it. It's on social media. It's spread by the word of mouth. It's becoming, I think, a platform for education and knowledge.
You actually, you speak to me very closely on that, because it is such a tolerant environment to live in. It's such a tolerant environment to bring your children up in. And even during the holy month of Ramadan here in the UAE, there's no sort of feeling of exclusion. You definitely feel part of the community.
Look, I take my little kids, I take them to the gas station during Ramadan, and they buy ice cream. And they eat it while they're actually eating the ice cream while they're leaving the gas station, getting in the car. People are looking. That's normal. And let me take you just a short one. In the days when we would say the religion has just started, the days of Prophet Muhammad, during Ramadan, there are people when they are traveling, there are people with the Prophet who are actually fasting, and there are people who are not fasting. The people who are fasting, they're actually helping the cooking and preparing the food for the people who are not fasting. It's a choice, especially when you're as a pregnant woman, as breastfeeding, as traveling, as a diabetic, you don't actually fast. And that feel of don't get yourself involved, and don't so be so picky, be so open-minded. That's the what Dubai have reached with the people, either Dubaians, either Muslims who are living here, and either Muslims around Dubai. When they come to the UAE, they understand this open-mindedness.
I have to say, your centre in particular, the Sheikh Mohammed Centre for Cultural Understanding, has done a huge amount to sort of explain and to dispel any of the myths surrounding being Emirati, being Arab, being Muslim.
You're listening to The Agenda with Georgia Tolley. Yeah!
On Dubai Eye, 103.8.
Hello there, welcome back. We are discussing the upcoming holy month of Ramadan. All of a sudden, it is just around the corner. It is expected to start on the 2nd of April, but of course that start date will be confirmed by the Moon Sighting Committee. Iftar tents are going to be allowed again for the first time in 2 years. They must be designed in the form of a canopy that's open from all sides or be air conditioned. Distance of at least 1 meter with the entry and exit process will be regulated by guards or volunteers. And the tents can open for 2 hours before the time of iftar, and to avoid congestion. And the green pass system must be applied. Of course, that is depending on the rules in place in each emirate. That's your Al Hosn pass. Disposable table covers, plates, cups and spoons are recommended. It is mandatory to use the table covers, the disposable table covers. So it is a huge change. Very, very interesting that has finally been brought back. Wonderful for the Muslim community. Joining us in the studio, I must emphasise, which is a first for me here on The Agenda for a couple of years, is Abdallah Al-Sakal. Now, he is the director of the Sheikh Mohammed Centre for Cultural Understanding. And I mean, for those of us who've lived in the country for many years, we know all about the Centre for Cultural Understanding. But for those of us, and we do have a very transient community here in the UAE, Abdallah, perhaps you could explain a little bit about what the centre does, you know, what its purpose is, and how you carry out those tasks.
Yes, the The program is called Open Doors, Open Minds for the Sheikh Mohammed Center for Cultural Understanding. For the last 27 years, it's creating as much Q&A sessions, programs through cultural events such as lunch, breakfast, dinner, fwala, which is the afternoon tea for Emiratis, majlis, guests, opening the mosques for people to ask questions, see for themselves what are the funny moves we do in a mosque, as a, how they look at it. Explaining, having Emiratis, we train a lot of graduates, retired Emiratis, male and female, so they can speak to others, explain to them simple questions about why do we dress in a certain way, what do we talk about with our wives at home, who are Emiratis. People want to know.
They do. I mean, my sister came to it. My sister lives in the UK. She came to one of your wonderful breakfasts and she was hosted by an Emirati, a young Emirati graduate, one lady and one man. And my sister really went for it. She really asked every single question she wanted to know. She wanted to know about women's lib. She wanted to know about, you know, whether people chose to wear headscarves. You know, she raised all the stereotypes and talked about them and really learned a huge amount as a consequence.
So this Ramadan is a normal experience of having the iftar, Emirati iftar. So private companies, public, book online on cultures.ae book for the groups, either individuals or private or public. It starts at about 6. An hour or half an hour before iftar, they experience the traditional Emirati breaking the fast and then seeing the prayers and then asking questions, taking photographs, dressing up. And this year, actually, we have themes. So this year, one theme will be the cooking. The second theme will be the food, the henna, the incense and the perfumes. So there are different themes for every week of Ramadan this year.
Fantastic. I've just checked out your website. If you want to find out more about those events, then you can go to cultures.ae and then you just select the cultural meals segment and you can book your Ramadan iftar meal there. So thank you so much, sir, for joining us in the studio. Really appreciate your help and your advice. And I'm sure that over the holy month, we will be asking you to come back and answer all the questions that come in.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, sir. So that was Abdallah Al-Sakal, who is the director of the Sheikh Mohammed Center for Cultural Understanding. Another piece of information that's just come through is that reduced working hours have been confirmed for the private sector firms in the UAE during Ramadan. The Ministry of Human Resources and Emiratization has announced that employees in the private sector will have their working day reduced by 2 hours during that holy month. Federal entities and ministries will remain open from 9 until 2:30 p.m. on Monday to Thursday during Ramadan. And on Fridays, the working hours will be 9 a.m. to midday.
Keeping you updated.
This is The Agenda with Georgia Tully
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
So in a recent survey that was actually published just in the last few hours, the UAE has ranked first in the region and 15th overall in the Global Soft Power Index. So we are going to discuss what soft power is and why it's so important for a country and how the UAE has managed to rank so highly. Maheen Rizvi Ahmed is a senior lecturer in international relations at Middlesex University in Dubai. She defines soft power for us in this clip and how the UAE has succeeded using it to its advantage.
Power is the ability to affect others or achieve the outcomes we want. Soft power is the ability to obtain preferred outcomes by attraction rather than coercion or payment. It is about influencing others by using ideas and is, according to Joseph Nye, who first came up with this term, a means to success in world politics for those that know how to leverage it. Over the years, the UAE's leadership have learned how to use soft power to create a brand, improving the reputation of the country by leaps and measures and increasing its influence both regionally and globally. There is no better example of effective use of soft power than Expo 2020 and the UAE's handling of the COVID-19 pandemic. A strong nation brand and positive soft power perceptions has allowed the UAE to promote itself as a place for people to visit and invest in. His Highness Sheikh Mohammed bin Rashid Al Maktoum perfectly encapsulated this when he tweeted, "The real soft power of the UAE is its development model that brings together the East and the West. It brings together the best ideas and minds and people of all cultures without discrimination to build the best development experience in the world."
Fascinating stuff there from Maheen Rizvi Ahmed, who is an international relations lecturer at Middlesex University in Dubai. It's a double whammy when it comes to professors, because we're joined on Microsoft Teams now by Adam Ramey, who is Associate Professor of Political Science at NYU Abu Dhabi. He joins me over the line. We can see each other's faces, which makes all the difference. How are you, Professor Ramey?
I'm doing very well, Georgia. It's really great to be with you this morning.
It's fantastic. And I have to say, I feel sort of slightly like I'm in a lecture theatre, because I'm learning a lot about soft power. I'm learning a lot about where the UAE ranks globally. But I want to sort of get more of a gist of where this idea of soft power first came from. You know, when did countries start to realise that they could leverage these sort of softer skills in order to improve their status, their global standing?
It's a very old concept, but I think it's become very important in the 21st century, and certainly during the later half of the 20th century it emerged. Because, you know, as the Cold War was this sort of massive military cold conflict between the U.S. bloc and the Soviet bloc, and there were various conflicts around the world, the Korean War, the Vietnam War, that involved, you know, weapons and military and traditional show of force. That's what you might call hard power, or sort of the showing muscle, if you will. I think a lot of countries in the later half of the Cold War and in the 21st century who were not so interested in sort of projecting their influence and their might and those means were looking for other ways in order to demonstrate their importance on the global scale. And I think soft power is one of the mechanisms by which this emerged. It's this idea that you don't necessarily have to have the biggest military or the biggest military budget in your country or a huge standing army, but you can exert influence in lots of other ways. Sometimes it's cultural, sometimes it's diplomatic, sometimes it's educational, sometimes it's being able to sort of see yourself or be seen by your peer countries around the world as a nation that's capable of fostering cooperation and hosting peace talks and negotiations. And I think certainly in this century, so far, at least for the most part, soft power seems to be way more important than hard power in terms of sort of being seen as important and critical in the world economy and the community of nations more broadly.
The United Arab Emirates is a pretty small country. To be number 15th on this global list is really quite impressive. How has the UAE specifically used soft power to its advantage?
Well, I think like in so many other ways, the UAE punches above its weight in so many aspects of life. And I think that the UAE has made a dedicated effort in the last couple of decades to making it known as a destination around the world for lots of different things, a destination for tourism, a destination for tolerance, you know, brought about first a couple of years ago with the Year of Tolerance, and now with the sort of the establishment of diplomatic ties with Israel, for example. Being known as a place that is a peace-loving and safe location, because, you know, if we look at global rankings, Abu Dhabi and Dubai rank, you know, in the top 20 of the most safe locations in the entire world. And I think this idea is being a place that is, you know, safe to live, a place that's safe to do business, a place that's safe to pray and worship, and a place that's seen as sort of a force for and a model for unity in a complicated and constantly changing world is something that's allowed the UAE to project itself high up on this list. And I expect that in coming years, we will grow even higher.
So as someone who lives in the country like you do, we know that that isn't just lip service. You know, it really is a very tolerant country. It is genuinely a great place to live. You know, it's not just PR, it's not just spin. But soft power nevertheless can be perceived as being slightly Machiavellian, you know, slightly deliberate? Maybe it's used to sort of to cover over, to create a veneer of something that actually isn't true. But can it also be a force for good?
Oh, of course. And I think that the way that the UAE has made use of its rise in soft power, it's not just a matter of an index. This is something that's actual real. It's enabled the UAE to have a seat at the table in ways that it might not have otherwise had in previous decades. You know, for a country the size of the UAE being, you know, around 10 million people, just shy of 10 million people, to rank so highly. You know, you look at the other countries that are in the top 15, many of them are sort of global superpowers. And for the UAE to be so high on that index, I think the effects of that are something that we see in daily life, no matter where you look. The UAE is included in important phone calls with global leaders. It's seen as an important peace broker and mediator, not just in regional capacity, but globally. I think the UAE is being seen as a serious partner for global peace and an important economic and political partner for countries in the East and the West, a true bridge between cultures. And so, you know, yes, of course, soft power, just like hard power, can be used for nefarious ends. But I think the way the UAE has done it has been to the benefit of its citizens and for the millions of residents who call this place home, like myself.
Really interesting interview. Thank you so much for your patience when we had some trouble with the line. I really appreciate your time, sir. Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Professor Adam Ramey, who's an associate professor of political science at NYU Abu Dhabi.
Keeping you updated.
This is The Agenda with Georgia Tolley
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Hello there, welcome back. Now, top humanitarian officials from all over the world are in Dubai to discuss how the needs of people can be met in places where people are seeing suffering and conflict. They're all taking part in the Dubai International Humanitarian Aid and Development Conference, which could not be taking place at a more pertinent time if you think about what's going on in Ukraine at the moment. Zina has been covering the story and keeping an eye on everything that's been said down at that conference. What's been going on over the last 24 hours, Z?
Well, one of the things that the conference really focuses on is the current status of refugees, not just in Ukraine, but all over the world. And I've been speaking to Anne Contrey. She's the director of the Ethics Office at the United Nations Refugee Agency. She's flown all the way from Geneva to speak at the conference. And she said that the number of displaced people is expected to go up drastically given the situation in Ukraine.
Generally, the numbers, unfortunately, are rising every day as we speak. We're already at 90 million displaced persons, including refugees, stateless persons or persons who are at risk of being stateless, and persons who are internally displaced in their own countries who can't leave and go across a border. With the recent events in Ukraine, you can imagine that number will go up exponentially because it's not yet over and people are leaving their homes every day.
And one of the things that officials there, not just, you know, the UN Agency of Refugees, but other officials are discussing is how to get aid to the people of Ukraine where people have either been displaced or trapped because of the conflict. I spoke to Dr. Hossam El-Sharkwai. He's the regional director of the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies here in the MENA region. And he told me that the effects of the crisis in the country are also felt in this part of the world.
The tragedy that is unfolding in the Ukraine is a humanitarian one. This is what we focus on. People of affected from all sides. The Red Crosses and Red Crescents are very active now all over that region. We have scaled up our activities with hundreds and hundreds of personnel, tons and tons of material. Some of it is coming from the Gulf, GCC countries, and all over the area, and other countries from all over the world. The needs are immense, and the effects are already rippling way outside of Ukraine to the Middle East and North Africa. Many of the countries in the Middle East and North Africa have students that have been studying in Ukraine that are trapped as well in the conflict, and we're trying to get them out safely home. The economic impact is already being felt around the world in terms of the cost of energy, cost of food. So it's now spread, and we are living it now day to day. The humanitarian consequences always end up on the table of the Red Crosses and Red Crescents of the world to deal with it, and we'll do our best.
And so the Red Cross is a very busy organization, as you can imagine. I also asked him to describe the difficulties that the Red Cross and Red Crescent face in their efforts to send help to conflict zones.
Offering assistance, humanitarian assistance, in the context of insecurity, conflict, war, is always a challenge. Security situations sometimes make it very difficult for us to get into certain areas. But we try. We work with our colleagues from the International Committee of the Red Cross, called the ICRC, who negotiate access with the different parties to a conflict, the people on both sides of the war. And we do this successfully often. Okay? We do negotiate ceasefires. We negotiate humanitarian corridors so people can get out if they want to get out. And importantly, we negotiate to get medicines and food and other supplies into people trapped in those places. It's not easy, but we do it. Humanitarian work is never easy. It's a challenge. In the Middle East and North Africa, people know that this part of the world, sadly, has also suffered from protracted crises and wars and natural disasters that don't go away. And we are there. We are the boots on the ground. We're the volunteers in every street, every day. Sometimes it's not in the news, but that's okay. It doesn't have to be in the news, but we're there serving people.
And Dr. Elshar Kwai also talked about COVID, because, of course, while cases are down here in the UAE, there are many countries that are still in desperate need of help. And he said that this virus has really highlighted the inequality between the rich and the poor.
COVID has proven that it discriminates. Viruses often don't discriminate. But what I mean is that its effect on the poor and the rich is very different. We saw that from the early days, when the personal protection equipment was not available to the poor. We saw that when the vaccines were available, when the vaccines were not available to the poor. And to this day, as we speak, the poorest countries in the world have the lowest vaccination coverage. That's not a coincidence. I was in Iraq a few months ago, in a clinic way outside of Baghdad, an hour outside of Baghdad, run by the Iraq Red Crescent. I sat with a mother and her children. None of them were wearing masks. And everybody is promoting masks, masks, masks. And I said, can I talk to you? How come you're not wearing the mask? She says, my son, the mask here costs about 30 cents, equivalent of 30 cents in the local currency. We're a family of 10. If I have to wear a mask for 30 cents, and those have to be replaced every day, sometimes more than once a day, it's either for me we wear masks, or we eat, or we don't eat. This is how it's affecting people. So this is real, and this is where we are scaling up our reach and support to families like this in the remote locations, in what we call the last mile.
So that was Dr. Hossam Elshar Kwai. He's the regional director of the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies here in the MENA region. And he's been speaking about humanitarian crises around the world and the challenges in sending aid to people in need.
Many thanks, Dee, for that fascinating coverage of that conference.
Keeping you updated and informed.
This is The Agenda with Georgia Tolley
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Welcome back, Georgia Tolley here, keeping you entertained for the next hour or so. And I've called in the battalion. I've called in my defences. I can't think of what the right phrase is. I've got the ARN News app editor, Seneha May Francis, joining me in the studio. I can't do it all on my own. And I've been relying on the ARN News Centre behind the scenes for many months now. And I'm forcing them to come out of their cloistered environment and actually broadcast on the radio. So not only is Seneha live on the radio right now, she's also live on Facebook. So if you want to look at Seneha and me, but mostly Seneha, she's here now. She actually hates me right now.
No pressure at all, Georgia.
I know.
To look good as well.
Thank goodness you're an experienced professional broadcaster and journalist, and it is fantastic to have you on the radio. Not least because we want to catch up on some of the latest news stories out of India. There has been a big vaccination drive, and this time to a new sector of the population. Is that right?
That's right. So starting today, children aged 12 to 14 years, they will be getting their COVID-19 vaccination done. The COVID-19 vaccine that will be administered to this age group is called Covivax. This is the third vaccine in India other than Covaxin and Covishield. Covivax is India's first indigenously developed vaccine. It has received emergency use authorization from India's drug regulator. And it'll be two doses, again, administered say, within 28 days. And it'll stored, they say, between 2 to 8 degrees Celsius. And the expected cost, according to the media reports from coming from India, is 145 Indian rupees. That's, say, roughly 7 dirhams. That's excluding taxes. And it is a big move. So it just means more of them getting vaccinated means it's the country is going to be more secure, and it just makes it easy for a lot of parents to think that this is a large population that needs to get their jab.
Can I just check? So are parents required to pay for it? It's not like here where it's free.
No, you have to pay for it unless it's a government run healthcare centres. And in addition to this, we also have people above 60 who will be able to take their booster shots. Earlier, it was a select eligible criteria. Now it's open to everyone. They can get their jab if they've completed 9 months from when they got their second jab. And the only guideline that they must adhere to is that the booster jab is the same vaccine from the first two doses. So you can't mix your vaccine. That's something the health authorities have reinforced and reinstated. So, yep, that's the update about the vaccination drive.
Because so the last time we really put our focus on COVID and vaccines in India was right at the beginning of this Omicron wave that we were all, I mean, genuinely slightly terrified could have as big an effect as Delta did on the Indian population. What are the latest when it comes to the COVID numbers?
Thankfully, the COVID numbers look a little better or more promising, if I could say that. India's logged 2,876 new cases. It takes the total tally of COVID cases to 42.99 million. The active cases have dipped, so that's to 32,811. All this data we get for today from the Union Health Ministry. And the death count has climbed to 516,072, and with 98 new fatalities recorded over the last 24 hours. The active cases, like I said, comprise 0.08% of the total infection. Recovery rate has further improved. It says it stands at 98.72%.
Oh, that's very good news. But do you know that number of 500,000 of people who've died from COVID in India? And those are just the sort of registered deaths.
It's heartbreaking. It just takes you back to the time, right, Georgia?
It does. I think so often in news, you just get used to sort of saying the stats. But for some reason, that's really made me realise. It's one of you have these sort of prismic moments, these sort of sudden moments where you're suddenly like, my gosh, 500,000 people. And do you remember when we used to talk about the previous pandemic, how X million of people died in the last pandemic 100 years ago? And everyone was like, oh, well, you know, maybe this one won't be as bad.
I agree. And I guess that just kind of reinforces why vaccination is so important. And it just means that if you need to get your jab, you need to protect yourself, you need to ensure that there are no other complications. Fatality is still high. The numbers should make you think, question, even if you kind of not, you know, a lot of people still question whether we need to, whether it protects us. I think the stats speak for itself.
Oh, and there's a lot of misinformation out there as well. Make sure you get all your news regarding vaccinations from not from Instagram, not from WhatsApp, but from valid news organisations or medical health organisations. Moving on to the connection between Ukraine and India, which isn't one that you necessarily would have expected to be there, but of course it is.
It is. A lot of students we have come to know how, you know, are pursuing medicine and, you know, different education streams in Ukraine. And the war, in a sense, has kind of put that spotlight on these students. A lot of them stranded. A lot of them have been evacuated back home, back home. But then it kind of puts the question of what happens to their education now that it's kind of, you know, they're back home and safe. But what about their studies? So one of the states in India, and this is quite remarkable, it's the Indian state of Telangana. They have come forward and said, we will fund their education. And this is Chief Minister K. Chandrasekhar Rao. He said, you know, they've gone through a lot and we'd like to take that burden away from them. And like I said before, you know, you wouldn't expect this kind of huge student population in Ukraine. But the stats show there are nearly 20,000 Indian students and most of them enrolled for courses in medicine. And one of the reasons is because, A, it's cheaper. And two, there's no, you know, some of the medical entrance exam in India is infamous for being really tough to pass.
Pass, yeah.
And so This is one way students who want to pursue a profession in medicine have this option. They pay around 35,000 US dollars in Ukraine, which for the same course in India is like four times that amount. So,
oh wow,
there's a reason why there is a massive student population.
Do they have to learn Ukrainian though? Like it must be. You think it's done in English?
No. Yeah, it's done in English.
Oh, okay.
That would be a little too much.
That's like the nth degree. Now we've got 2 minutes to go and two stories to do in it. We're going to move on to something slightly lighter because I hear rumours there's a man in India who has a solution to tackling the rising fuel prices in the country.
This one had me laugh. I think it's quite delightful to see people finding these quirky ways to, you know, tackle fuel price hike. And this man, he's from Maharashtra. His name is Sheikh Yusuf. And he claims he's found a feasible option to the price rise, fuel price rise. And he has invested in a horse. So he works as a lab assistant at a college. I'm not making this up. And he rides to work daily. And he's named his horse Jigar, which means heart. And he's bought it during the COVID lockdown for 40,000 Indian rupees. That's roughly 1,900 dirhams. And obviously, he's got the video of him riding to work has, you know, taken the internet by storm. Some say it's cool, but some say, why didn't he invest in a cycle instead? That's most cost effective.
He must just really like horses.
And a lot of people said it means you're not cruel to any animals. You know, you can just take a... You
it's
can just
not
ride
cruel a, to ride a horse, though.
You can just get a bicycle.
It's not cruel to ride horses. They're all right. You know, they've got four legs. They're very large. Okay, so before you go, I know there's some big news from Bollywood. We've got about 30 seconds. What's the latest Bollywood goss?
Well, Bollywood superstar Shah Rukh Khan has big news for us. He took the internet by storm again last night, saying he's going to launch a streaming platform app called SRK Plus. However, some digging up that I did this morning, some news media reports say that it's a completely different story. This is a teaser for an ad for Disney Plus Hotstar. And not a streaming platform. But let's wait and see what Shah Rukh has to say to that.
Interesting stuff. Sneha May Francis, the ARN News app editor, also a superstar reporter on Indian stories and others. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Georgia.
It's been a pleasure.
Keeping you updated.
This is The Agenda with Georgia Tolley
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Welcome back. The Dubai International Humanitarian Aid and Development Conference is taking place in the United Arab Emirates at the moment. It's attended by delegates from global organisations such as the UN and the Red Cross. Now, one of the hot topics for them is how to handle the number of displaced people in the world. Anne Enconte, who is the director of the Ethics Office at the United Nations Refugee Agency in Geneva, said the problem of displaced people is increasing.
Generally, the numbers, unfortunately, are rising every day as we speak. We're already at 90 million displaced persons, including refugees, stateless persons or persons who are at risk of being stateless, and persons who are internally displaced in their own countries who can't leave and go across the border. With the recent events in Ukraine, you can imagine that number will go up exponentially because it's not yet over and people are leaving their homes every day.
One of the most immediate and, of course, dire effects of displacement and conflict is hunger. And according to the World Food Programme, over 800 million people around the world do not have enough food. Furthermore, 44 million people in 38 countries are at risk of sliding into famine, which is, of course, the most extreme form of hunger and can result in death from starvation or disease. To discuss what governments and what people can do, what we can do, I'm joined by Majid Yahya, who is the director of the World Food Programme in this region and a very busy man, joining me on Microsoft Teams. Hello there, Majid. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak to us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
It's lovely to have you on the radio. Now, I mean, I remember the subject of famine from my childhood. Back then, it was Ethiopia that was the focus. What areas are struggling the most now?
Well, now many areas around the world are struggling with the severe food insecurity. This is mainly caused by the armed conflict, by the climate change, and add to it the COVID. also what added to the situation. Today, we are talking about armed conflicts in Yemen with 17 million people, also with severely food insecure. We're talking about Syria, South Sudan, the Sahel in Africa, the Horn of Africa, Afghanistan and Syria. So it's now it's increasing. Now we have also the situation in Ukraine. Around 3 million people who have crossed the borders from Ukraine to neighboring countries in Moldova, in Poland and so on. So this is adding to the situation, which is already fragile. We expected that by the end of 2020, COVID and the effects of COVID will be behind us. But adding to what is going on today and the increase in numbers also of the insecure population is adding to the situation, is becoming really worse. You have just mentioned about 45 million people in 38 countries. They are just one step away from famine. So the situation, not just like in the 80s, where it was just in the Horn of Africa and Ethiopia, but it's scattered in different parts of the world.
It's very interesting there how you describe the connection there between conflict and famine. You know, in the past, I think the some of the famines were caused by, for example, extreme weather or drought. But now this sort of the conflict has stepped into that breach. Now, I want to come to Ukraine in just a minute. But can you describe in what way COVID-19 has led to increased food insecurity, to increased hunger?
During the lockdown period, talking about Africa, for example, 80% of the population in Africa are in the informal business. So the lockdown, because of the lockdown, they had to stay home. Markets were closed. Their income vanished. So their food security shaken. And of course, this is added, of course, to the situation. The other also is the climate, if the climate change effect. And this is real. It's happening. And it's adding to the situation of food security. You're talking about the Sahel, which is experiencing droughts, which creates conflicts, creates displacement, creates migration. The same thing now again and again happening in the Horn of Africa. Afghanistan, for example, is the third consecutive year experiencing drought. So all this together, of course, aggravates the food security situation around the world.
It does feel like an insurmountable problem, especially when you've had what's happened in the last three weeks with Ukraine. I have to say I was, I think because I haven't really followed conflict from the very start, I think I was absolutely astonished at how quickly food, how quickly hunger became a problem. Because, of course, once a country is in a war, then the food distribution just ceases and quickly the supermarkets run out.
And it's happening in one of the world's breadbaskets, Ukraine. Ukraine and Russia combined, they contribute 30% of them of the global needs of wheat and grains. The sunflower also is one of the major produce of them of both countries. In the World Food Program, 50% of our purchase of wheat comes from Ukraine. So what is happening today is that there is disruption in the supply chain of wheat. There is increase in the oil price, which increased the shipping price. The Black Sea corridor, which is one of the important corridors for the grain supplies, is also affected. All this adding, of course, to the increase in the price. Wheat price has increased for the first time since 2012. And of course, this is adding to our requirements in terms of funding. So adding just in the last 3 weeks, what's happened in Ukraine added $50 to $70 million to our monthly operational cost. This is just as the result of the last of what happened the last 3 weeks. And this, of course, is expected to go on, hopefully not. But if it continues like this, then the situation is getting more worse and is getting more aggravated.
Are you getting support from global governments? Have they realized that the extent of this crisis and are they providing you with more funds?
Well, during the COVID, we have been we received a generous contribution from our donors, the member states around the world. But today, even before the Ukraine crisis, because of the effects of the COVID, most of the donors' countries, they have shifted their focus domestically, rightly so. So we are facing an unprecedented situation in shortage of funding. In Yemen, in January, we had to cut our ration by 50%. So you can imagine the effect of that on the population there. This is a situation where you have 17 million people on the brink of starvation, call it. So cutting rations, what is going to mean? It's going to mean more people are going to move to more vulnerable status of food insecurity. We appeal to the world. We appeal to our donors, countries. We appeal to the public to help us, because food security is security in itself. When we have a food insecurity situation, be it in a because of conflict, be it of climate, be it of the COVID now, it will not stay where it moves. It spread be it with migration, radicalization, child marriage, and all these things. So it does not stay where it is, and the whole world will feel the effect of what happens in some parts of the world.
The UAE is a central hub for aid distribution and a contributor to many World Food Programme projects. How does that work here in the UAE? Is it just due to its location that it's such a key hub?
Well, location is key, absolutely. I mean, today we are in Dihad here, and this is like an event where you get also all the partners together. I have done, like, since morning, this is the cell interview I do. So by doing this, it's helped us also spread the word about what's happening. UAE is also one of our major donors. Recently, the UAE has given the World Food Programme $60 million for our operation in Ethiopia. The location, as I said, it's key to our operation. From here, is our focus is not just the Middle East and North Africa, but the rest of the world. Recently, just the last 2 weeks, we have been sending airplanes from Dubai to Poland, carrying equipment, carrying armored vehicles, carrying ready-to-eat meals. This is through contribution also from our host, which is the International Humanitarian City. So there is also, apart from the location, there is the logistic infrastructure, that there is zero bureaucracy in moving cargo in and out of Dubai. And that is a great help for any humanitarian organization that needs to respond on time.
So thank you so much for your time. Thank you for speaking so eloquently to us. I really appreciate it. And I wish you all the best with your very, very important work. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. That was Majid Yahya. He is the director of the World Food Programme in this region. If you want to check out the World Food Programme website to find out a little bit more about their work, you can go to WFP.org. That's WFP.org.
Keeping you updated
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
You're listening to The Agenda with Georgia Tolley.
The Agenda is live Monday to Friday from 10 a.m. till 1 p.m.